From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This act is the product of a coordinated, premeditated campaign of political retribution, the all-too-predictable result of a vengeful investigation led by a partisan fanatic.
At last count, that total stood at 15, 12 of whom were Democrats and 3 of whom were Republicans. Our job is to prosecute abuses of power.
Tom DeLay steps down as House Majority Leader after he's indicted in Texas. We'll take a look at the scandal surrounding the most powerful Republican in the House and the Senate, Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist. The SEC has launched a formal investigation into allegations that he engaged in insider trading. Then we look at the FBI killing of Puerto Rican independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios.
To most North Americans and the United States government, he was thought as a terrorist. But the Puerto Rican people, he's a national hero. He's admired another person because he symbolized the struggle of our people, the resistance of our people against colonialism and against the imposition of a government against the will of our people. We want to be free, and Filiberto Ojeda was the symbol of that struggle.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. One of the most powerful Republican politicians in history has been forced to step down as House Majority Leader after a Texas grand jury indicted him on a charge of conspiring to violate election laws. Tom DeLay, who's known as the Hammer, is accused of conspiring with 2 previously indicted aides to violate a ban on the use of corporate money by state political candidates by funneling thousands of dollars in corporate contributions through the Republican National Committee. Analysts say Wednesday's indictment is just the tip of an iceberg of corruption allegations against DeLay. House Republicans gathered within hours of the indictments becoming public and chose Congressmember Roy Blunt of Missouri to replace DeLay, who was forced to step down because of House rules. As Washington buzzed with talk of the end of DeLay's career, the Hammer hit back, holding a news conference proclaiming his innocence. DeLay described the veteran Democratic prosecutor who brought the indictment, Ronnie Earl, as a partisan fanatic leading a coordinated, premeditated campaign of political retribution.
It's a charge that cannot hold up even under the most glancing scrutiny. This act is the product of a coordinated, premeditated campaign of political retribution, the all-too-predictable result of a vengeful investigation led by a partisan fanatic.
As the Republican congressional leadership rallied around DeLay, so too did the White House. This is spokesperson Scott McClellan.
Yes, Congressman DeLay is a good ally, a leader who we have worked closely with to get things done for the American people.
We'll have much more on this story just after headlines. As Republicans scrambled to defend Tom DeLay, there were significant developments in a scandal involving the Senate's top Republican, Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has given subpoena power to investigators looking into potential insider trading by Frist of shares of his family's corporation, the Healthcare Corporation of America. The SEC has officially changed the investigation status from informal to formal. The Nonpartisan Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights estimates Frist made between $2 and $6 million by selling his HCA holdings just before stock values plummeted in the face of a bad earnings report. Louisiana's official death toll from Hurricane Katrina has risen to 896. Most of the bodies have been brought to a temporary morgue set up in St. Gabriel, about 15 miles from Baton Rouge, while more than 100 bodies remain in local parish coroner's offices. Only 32 bodies have been released to families for burial as authorities scramble to identify the dead. Despite reports of many beatings and throat slit at the convention center and Superdome in New Orleans, the Department of Health and Hospitals said only 2 bodies found at those evacuation sites were believed to be murder victims. They reportedly had gunshot wounds. Senate Democrats are calling for an investigation into allegations that oil giant ExxonMobil has artificially pushed up the price of gasoline in the wake of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. The Democrats cite accusations from some gas station owners that they'd been ordered by the company to raise prices at the pump. The American Automobile Association said on September 9th that disgruntled gasoline station owners find themselves in a dilemma because of alleged pressure from ExxonMobil. Eight Democratic governors have demanded Congress and President Bush launch an investigation into possible price gouging. President Bush's new envoy on repairing the U.S. global reputation, Undersecretary of State Karen Hughes, wraps up her tour of several Middle Eastern countries today, capping off a trip that was marked by several confrontations over the occupation of Iraq. A group of Turkish female activists confronted Hughes Wednesday over the occupation, while she faced similar hostility from a gathering of women in Saudi Arabia. Hughes is a longtime confidant of President Bush. Earlier this month, she was tasked with repairing the U.S. image internationally. While she did face confrontations, her trip was dominated by friendly meetings with audiences filled with people and groups who receive U.S. funding or consisted of former exchange students. When Hughes visited Turkey, however, none of the activists she met with received U.S. funds, and six of the eight women who spoke at the session focused on the Iraq War. Fatma Nevin Vargun, a Kurdish women's rights activist, told Hughes, quote, "War makes the rights of women completely erased, and poverty comes after war, and women pay the price." Vargun also denounced the arrest of Cindy Sheehan in front of the White House on Monday at an anti-war protest. The Washington Post reports as the meeting went on, Hughes looked, quote, "increasingly pained." Hughes defended the Iraq invasion, saying, "You're concerned about war, and no one likes war. But," she said, "to preserve the peace, sometimes my country believes war is necessary." Another Turkish activist shot back, "War is not necessary for peace. We can never, ever export democracy and freedom from one country to another," the Turkish activist said. As Karen Hughes traveled, a new report was released on the international view of the U.S. It was compiled by a 9-member advisory committee headed by former Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff. The report found widespread hostility toward the U.S. and its policies, especially the occupation of Iraq. The report said, quote, "For what can be heard around the world in the wake of the invasion of Iraq, the prisoner abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib, and the controversy over the handling of detainees at Bagram and Guantanamo Bay, is that America is less a beacon of hope than a dangerous force to be countered." The Reuters news agency says the conduct of U.S. troops in Iraq, including increasing detention and accidental shootings of journalists, is preventing full coverage of the war from reaching the American public. In a letter to Virginia Republican Senator John Warner, head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Reuters said U.S. forces were limiting the ability of independent journalists to operate. The letter from the agency's global managing editor, David Schlesinger, called on Warner to raise these issues with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who's due to testify to the committee today. Schlesinger referred to, quote, "a long parade of disturbing incidents whereby professional journalists have been killed, wrongfully detained, and or illegally abused by U.S. forces in Iraq. At least 66 journalists and media workers, most of them Iraqis, have been killed in Iraq since March 2003. U.S. forces acknowledge killing three Reuters journalists, most recently sound man Waleed Khaled, who was shot by American soldiers August 28th while on assignment in Baghdad. The Pentagon says these soldiers were justified in opening fire. Reuters believes a fourth Reuters journalist, who died in Ramadi last year, was killed by a U.S. sniper. Schlesinger said the Pentagon has refused to conduct independent and transparent investigations into the deaths of the journalists, relying instead on inquiries by officers from the units responsible who had exonerated their soldiers. And finally, the first African-American woman to serve as a federal judge has passed away. Famed civil rights lawyer Constance Baker Motley died Wednesday in New York. She was 84 years old. As a young lawyer, Motley represented Martin Luther King Jr. After a brief political career, she began a distinguished four-decade span as a judge in 1966, becoming the first black woman appointed to the federal bench. Motley earned her degree in economics in 1943 from New York University. 3 years later, she obtained her law degree from Columbia Law School. In 1945, she became a law clerk to Thurgood Marshall, who was then chief counsel of the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund. In the late 50s, Motley took an interest in politics and by 1964 had left the NAACP and become the first black woman to serve in the New York State Senate. In 1965, she became the first woman to serve as president of the Borough of Manhattan, where she worked to promote integration in public schools. In her career, she worked on some of the nation's most famous civil rights cases, including preparing the draft complaint in 1950 for what would become Brown v. Board of Education. From 1961 to 64, Motley won 9 of 10 civil rights cases she argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our viewers and listeners. A Texas grand jury on Wednesday indicted House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and two political associates on charges of conspiracy in a campaign finance scheme. DeLay is temporarily stepping down from his post as Majority Leader, the number two ranking Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives. GOP House rules require DeLay to give up his leadership position because of the indictment, but he's allowed to retain his congressional seat. DeLay has denied the charges and accused the prosecutor who lodged them, Ronnie Earle, of conducting a political witch hunt against him.
In an act of blatant political partisanship, a rogue district attorney in Travis County, Texas, named Ronnie Earle, charged me with one count of criminal conspiracy, a reckless charge wholly unsupported by the facts. This is one of the weakest, most baseless indictments in American history. It's a sham, and Mr. Earle knows it. It's a charge that cannot hold up even under the most glancing scrutiny. This act is the product of a coordinated, premeditated campaign of political retribution, the all-too-predictable result of a vengeful investigation led by a partisan fanatic.
Longtime Travis County District Attorney Ronnie Earle is a Democrat with a long history of going after politicians on both sides of the aisle. He defended the accusations of partisanship made by DeLay and recounted his past record of prosecutions.
At last count, that total stood at 15, 12 of whom were Democrats and 3 of whom were Republicans. Our job is to prosecute abuses of power, and our job is to bring those abuses to the attention of the public through juries, and that's what we do when we find a violation of the law.
Tom DeLay could face up to 2 years in prison if convicted on the charge handed up by the Travis County Grand Jury in Austin. He's the first House leader to be indicted in office in at least a century. Republicans quickly rallied behind DeLay and announced their support for his return as House Majority Leader. House Speaker Dennis Hastert emerged from a meeting with House GOP leaders late Wednesday afternoon and announced DeLay's replacement as House Majority Leader.
The wisdom of the conference today was to move forward. We've elected Roy Blunt as the temporary leader in the House. With him, we've had asked a couple people to kind of step up and help take on responsibilities. Eric Cantor will, as deputy whip, will also assume extra duties in the whip office. And David Dreyer, as a chairman of the Rules Committee, will help us work with the chairman and move the agenda through across the House floor. And make recommendations to both Roy and myself. I think our members were decisive. We're ready to go to work and roll up our sleeves, and we will finish our agenda and get through this year with flying colors. Roy Blunt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think it's fair to say that our members today, while they express great regret that Tom DeLay has had to go through what he's going through right now, I think largely because of his effectiveness as a leader. He became a target. We all believe that he'll return once this indictment is out of the way to be the leader again. That's what our rules call for. That's why my current situation will be to act as temporary leader. Tom would come back as leader. But he'll continue to be an important member of this House, an important part of getting our work done. He's still a member of Congress, is going to be an effective and influential part of what we're doing as he works now to get beyond this terribly unfair thing that's happened.
Republican Congressmember Roy Blunt of Missouri and House Speaker Dennis Hastert in a news conference on Wednesday.
Tom DeLay was indicted on a single conspiracy charge tied to illegal fundraising activities in Texas. The indictment accuses him and two alleged co-conspirators, John Caliandro and Jim Ellis, of engaging in a scheme to launder $190,000 in corporate donations through the Republican National Committee for distribution to Republican candidates for the Texas legislature. The money was funneled to the RNC from Texans for a Republican Majority Political Action Committee, or TRIMPAC, which was created by DeLay and Associates for the 2002 state elections. Texas law generally prohibits corporate money from being used for campaign activities.
TRIMPAC's money and expertise helped Republicans win control of the Texas legislature for the first time since Reconstruction. At DeLay's urging, the legislature then conducted a controversial remapping of congressional districts that resulted in more Republicans from Texas being elected to the U.S. House. TRIMPAC itself was indicted on September 8th for accepting illegal corporate funds. Eight corporations and an industry lobbying group have also been indicted during the 34-month probe. At the White House, the president's chief spokesperson, Scott McClellan, expressed support for DeLay.
Yes, Congressman DeLay is a good ally, a leader who we have worked closely with to get things done for the American people.
Tom DeLay is an 11-term Congress member from the Houston area, elected Majority Whip in 94 and became House Majority Leader in 2002. His reputation as a tough party enforcer has earned him the nickname The Hammer. With DeLay under fire for three admonishments by the House Ethics Committee on separate issues, and amid concerns about the grand jury investigation in Texas, House Republicans changed a rule in November 2004 so that DeLay could keep his leadership post in the event he was indicted. But they were forced to reverse the move 2 months later following public outcry. We're joined right now from Austin by the executive editor of the Texas Observer, Jake Bernstein. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you talk about the significance of this indictment? And though we have described it somewhat, exactly what Ronnie Earl has charged Congressmember DeLay with?
Well, what you said at the beginning of the program is it really highlights the significance of it. This is the first time in over a century, I think, that a leader in the Congress has been, a sitting leader in the Congress has been indicted. And the fact that he had to step down is nothing short of extraordinary. I mean, this investigation has been going on for several years now, and it's almost like people here in Austin have been holding their breath, and yesterday they finally exhaled. The significance or the substance of the indictment, there's really not much to go on, unfortunately. I mean, it's a conspiracy charge, and Ronnie Earl, the Travis County District Attorney, did not really go into the evidence behind that charge yesterday. So it's left a lot of people scratching their heads exactly what ties Tom DeLay specifically to this $190,000 that is a part of a money laundering allegation.
And of course, for viewers and listeners who are not in Texas, from other parts of the country, this the alleged funneling of money involved eventually a redistricting that had enormous impact nationwide in terms of the balance of power in Congress. Could you talk about redistricting?
Sure. It was sort of an unprecedented mid-decade redistricting that happened here in Texas, and the result was quite favorable to Tom DeLay and the Republicans. They picked up seven new seats, which certainly went a long way towards to keeping the Congress Republican for a long time to come. As far as the specific money, it's for over 100 years, it's been illegal to spend corporate money on candidates here in Texas. It's a legacy of the populace back at the turn of the century who were going after the big railroad barons, or at least trying to curtail their power. What's alleged to have happened is that $190,000, actually a blank check, was sent up to Washington by the executive director of TRIMPAC, Texans for Republican Majority, where it was received by Jim Ellis, who is still the director of Tom DeLay's national PAC, Americans for Republican Majority. Now, Ellis then gave it to the Republican National Committee, apparently, according to the indictments, with specific instructions that it be returned as hard money, which could be spent on candidates, to seven specific House candidates, state House candidates here in Texas.
We are talking with executive editor of the Texas Observer, Jake Bernstein. And when we come back, he'll also be joined by Doug Ireland, longtime political journalist, to talk about Tom DeLay, who has just been indicted, the majority leader of the House. And then we'll talk about the majority leader of the Senate, Dr. Bill Frist, also in trouble. Stay with us. Wes Montgomery and Jimmy Smith here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 375 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks. You can check us out at DirecTV Channel 375 or on Dish Network Channel 9410 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines also in Spanish, audio and transcript at our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we look at the House Majority Leader, Tom DeLay, and the indictment against him just yesterday, as well as the appointment of the man or men to replace him. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Our guest is Jake Bernstein, executive editor of the Texas Observer. In a nutshell, can you give us a history of Tom DeLay's career?
Well, Tom DeLay started famously as an exterminator. He was an exterminator in Sugar Land, Texas, who apparently was fed up with EPA rules. And that was sort of the platform that he ran on to get into the state house. He got into the state house and was a state rep here in Texas for a little while and then moved on to Congress. And his rise in Congress has been fairly meteoric. He's now, as you know, majority leader. He kind of was on the outs with Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution, but managed still to become majority leader. But what the power of Tom DeLay really is the money. He is a prodigious fundraiser. He has been very, very successful at raising money and parceling it out to Republican candidates. And that's really the currency that's most important in Washington these days.
I wanted to replay a clip we just played, and that is of Dennis Hastert talking about who will replace Tom DeLay in the House. Listen carefully.
The wisdom of the conference today was to move forward. We've elected Roy Blunt as the temporary leader in the House. With him, we've had asked a couple people kind of step up and help take on responsibilities. Eric Cantor will, as Deputy Whip, will also assume extra duties in the Whip office. And David Dreyer, as the Chairman of the Rules Committee, will help us work with the Chairman and move the agenda through across the House floor and make recommendations to both Roy and myself. I think our members were decisive. We're ready to go to work and roll up our sleeves. And we will finish our agenda and get through this year with flying colors.
House Speaker Dennis Hastert, yes, he said that Roy Blunt would replace Tom DeLay with help from, among others, David Dreyer. Doug Ireland joins us on the program today, longtime political journalist, media critic, runs a blog called Dreyerland. Can you talk about the men who will and will not replace Tom DeLay, Doug?
Well, you have in Roy Blunt, a pillar of Republican conservatism and a darling of the religious right, whose appointment was hailed by groups like the Family Research Council, the right-wing Christian right lobby, as being a wonderful thing. David Dreyer, the chairman of the House Rules Committee and one of the most powerful men in Congress, is very interestingly, the Washington Post, in its story yesterday before, when Hastert had first recommended Dreyer as the replacement for the delay, not Blunt, the Washington Post called him a different kind of Republican in its headline. Well, that's kind of amusing because Dreyer is a different kind of Republican. He's a closeted gay man who has lived with his chief of staff, Brad Smith, in a relationship for many years. And closet case Dreyer consistently votes against full rights for gay people. And he's voted against within the last 10 days the inclusion of gay people in the Hate Crimes Prevention Act. He's voted against the Housing for People with AIDS program, which helps poor people with AIDS to have a place to live. He's voted against allowing gay couples in the District of Columbia to adopt children. He's opposed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which the Congress has yet to pass, which would prevent discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in employment. So all these things, of course, Mr. Blunt is in agreement on this homophobic political line that the Republicans used to win the election last year.
So, Doug, there were several press reports that did indicate that there was a concern about the most conservative groups within the Republican Party about Dreyer taking the lead role in replacing DeLay. So is it your speculation or your sense that despite his consistently conservative record, that there were those who were opposed to him because of his own gay relationship?
The fact that Congressman Dreyer is gay and in the closet is pretty widely known in the Republican House Conference. I think that there were multiple reasons why the Republican Conference, rejected him in favor of Blunt. I think that the fact that Dreyer was a gay closet case was a contributing factor. So was the fact that Dreyer, in one of his few divergences from the conservative Republican line, is pro-choice, although he favors a lot of limitations on abortion. And another factor is that there's been a lot of grumbling in the House Republican Conference among GOP members of Congress since the House was reorganized after last year's congressional elections about the fact that so many Californians have powerful House committee chairmanships. They control, members of Congress from California control about half a dozen of the most powerful committees in the Congress. And there's been a lot of resentment from people in other parts of the country, Republican members of Congress, about that. And elevating Dreyer to majority leader from chairmanship of the Rules Committee would have made a Californian the top Republican in the House. So that, I think, was also a contributing factor. But, yes, there was a feeling that Dreyer was not conservative enough. He's pretty conservative, but not conservative enough. Blunt is a dyed-in-the-wool Christian conservative, darling of the religious right.
Talking about Blunt, the Washington Post has an interesting piece today saying as majority whip, Blunt, even more than DeLay before him, has created a formal alliance with K Street lobbyists, empowering corporate representatives and trade association executives to assist the House leadership in counting votes and negotiating amendments to bring holdouts into the fold. Jake Bernstein, I want to ask you about this. The Post goes on to say last year when the House leadership faced apparently insurmountable odds in passing legislation eliminating a $50 billion export tax break, the lobbying community stepped in to add billions of new tax breaks for major corporations with facilities in nearly every district: General Electric, Boeing, Caterpillar, United Technologies, Honeywell, and Emerson. The support built up majority backing for the measure. And then it says Blunt's best known special interest intervention was the 2003 late night attempt, unsuccessful as it turned out, to add an amendment sought by Philip Morris. Blunt's son then was a lobbyist for Philip Morris in Missouri. Blunt himself was dating a Philip Morris lobbyist whom he later married, and he'd received more than $150,000 in contributions from the company and subsidiaries. Jake Bernstein.
Well, it's hard to make the argument that this is a clean start. The Associated Press reported yesterday that Blunt's Political Action Committee has actually paid $88,000 to Jim Ellis, who is one of the people who's been indicted in this campaign scandal here in Texas, as a consultant for work that Ellis did for Blunt's Political Action Committee. So this is a very sort of incestuous group of politicians.
Let's turn now from the House Majority Leader, who's now under indictment, to the, well, it turns out, scandal-ridden Senate Majority Leader, Dr. Bill Frist. Juan?
Yes, well, DeLay's indictment is the latest in a recent spate of ethical high-ranking Republicans or Bush administration officials having problems. Last week, it was disclosed that Senate Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist was under federal investigation for a stock sale. The Wall Street Journal is now reporting that the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has given subpoena power to investigators looking into potential insider trading by Frist of shares in his family's corporation, HCA, the Hospital Corporation of America. The SEC has officially changed the investigation status from informal to formal. The Nonpartisan Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights estimates that Frist made between $2 million and $6 million by selling his HCA holdings just before stock values plummeted in the face of a bad earnings report.
Doug Ireland, you are writing about, well, your headline in your blog, Ireland, says the bad doctor. Talk about Frist. You've been following him for years.
Well, the interesting thing that we're not reading in the mainstream corporate media is just what the Frist family company, HCA, Hospital Corporation of America, was all about. When the Bush administration came into office, HCA had been for nearly a decade the target of one of the most extensive federal investigations of any corporation in the history of the United States. And HCA was, in fact, one of the largest corporate swindles in American history. The company that provided the family money that Bill Frist used to buy himself a Senate seat from the state of Tennessee was obtained by fraud and fraud on the government. But the HCA defrauded for years and years the programs designed to help poor Americans get health care. HCA defrauded Medicaid, it defrauded Medicare, and it defrauded TRICARE, which is, of course, the federal program that covers the military and their families. The government case against HCA was basically that the Frist family company kept two sets of books and fraudulently overbilled the government. It inflated its expenses. It billed the government for the inflated overrun. It violated both law and medical ethics when the company increased its Medicare billings by exaggerating the seriousness of illnesses they were treating. It bribed doctors in a whole-scale bribery operation. It gives them partnerships in HCA hospitals as a kickback for the doctors referring patients to HCA. Gave them free gifts, loans that were never expected to be paid back. Gave them free rent, free office furniture, free drugs from hospital pharmacies. All this to bribe the doctors into referring patients to HCA companies. When the Bushies came in, at a time when this investigation, which the deputy FBI director said was one of the most important the FBI had ever conducted into corporate America, it was expected that Bill Frist's brother, Thomas, who was one of the richest men in America, fortune estimated at over $2 billion, was going to be indicted along with a raft of HCA executives. But the Bushies and John Ashcroft decided otherwise, and they arranged a little sweetheart deal with the Frist family, with Bill Frist's brother, Tom, and the executives of the Frist family business, HCA, that let them get off the hook without any jail time. They did have to pay a fine, and the size of the fine tells you just how massive the fraud was, because the fine was for $1.7 billion, with a B, $1.7 billion that HCA had to pay the government for the fraud that it had committed.
Now, Doug, that was one of the largest fines in U.S. history, wasn't it?
And it was the largest. It broke the record. The previous old record had been set by Drexel Burnham.
But there were no indictments in the case. Were there no criminal charges?
There were huge crimes, but no criminals went to jail. Not Tom Frist, Bill Frist's brother, not a single HCA executive went to the can.
Now, the Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, has always said that his money is in a blind trust, so it doesn't compromise him. What about this news, Wall Street Journal reporting, that the SEC has opened a formal investigation into selling off this stock? So he was directing the person in charge of the trust.
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that Frist got rid of this stock for two reasons. Number one, he wants to be president, and having stock in a company that was one of the biggest corporate criminals in American history, when it was a family-owned company, is not exactly a credential you want to present to the American public if you're asking for their votes to become their president. But more than that, I would say that if Bill Frist was really a patriot first, he would have sold his HCA stock a long time ago, because the company was built on criminal activity. The company was a giant criminal conspiracy that defrauded the programs of the federal government designed to give poor people health care.
We're talking to Doug Ireland. He runs the blog Direland, longtime political journalist and media critic. As we wrap up this section, yes, we've talked about Dr. Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, Tom DeLay, under indictment right now, the House Majority Leader. Then there's Jack Abramoff. There's David Safavian, the President's Chief Procurement Officer, stepped down 2 weeks ago, arrested last week on charges of lying to investigators and obstructing a separate federal investigation into Jack Abramoff's dealings in Washington. Jake Bernstein, executive editor of the Texas Observer, what about Jack Abramoff, the Republican super lobbyist, as Salon.com describes him, known to have bragged about his contacts with Karl Rove, indicted in Florida last month, along with his business partner on wire fraud and conspiracy fraud charges related to their purchase of a fleet of gambling boats. This week, three men were arrested, including two who received payments from Abramoff's business partner in the mafia-style killing of the man from whom Abramoff and his partner purchased the gambling boats, and Jack Abramoff's ties to, well, Tom DeLay.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we always thought here in Austin that Tom DeLay was in more trouble because of Jack Abramoff than he would be because of Trimpac. Now, Abramoff received $82 million from six Indian tribes. And he spent that money in all kinds of places, including for sniper training on the West Bank, which clearly had nothing to do with what the Indians were expecting it was going to be spent on. He paid for DeLay to go to a trip to Scotland. DeLay called Abramoff my very good friend, Jack Abramoff. Abramoff was clearly trading on his friendship with Tom DeLay in all kinds of places. The Abramoff scandal implicates Grover Norquist. It also touches on
why Grover Norquist.
Well, Grover Norquist actually received money, this Indian tribe money. He was selling visits to the White House with the president. So the Indian tribes would give $25,000 through Abramoff to Norquist's organization, and then they would get a meeting with the president and a visit to the White House. It also implicates Ralph Reed, who was taking money from Abramoff, this Indian money, to campaign against Indian tribes here in Texas, which would then benefit other Indian casinos in other states.
And, of course, Ralph Reed, also former head of the Christian Coalition. And then you have Timothy Flanagan, the president's nominee to serve as deputy attorney general. Under Alberto Gonzalez, the eight Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday called for a new round of questioning of the nominee for the number two job at Justice, seeking more information about his links with indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Now, Flanagan has said he will have to recuse himself from the Abramoff investigation if he's confirmed, because he hired Abramoff to help the company where he works, scandal-ridden Tyco International, lobby DeLay and Rove on tax issues. Jake.
Now, certainly, if Abramoff decides to sing to save his skin, he is very, very conversant with the whole Republican fundraising network, with all kinds of details that could implicate a number of Republicans throughout the administration and Congress. And so certainly I think people have been nervous about that. Abramoff sort of intonated months ago that he was not willing to go down alone, which was why there was so much speculation that testimony from Abramoff could be very damaging to Tom DeLay.
Well, I want to thank you, Jake Bernstein, executive editor of the Texas Observer, for joining us in Austin. And Doug Ireland, longtime political journalist, media critic, writes the blog Direland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, more than 10,000 people came out for his funeral in Puerto Rico this week. The FBI killed him last week. We're going to talk about the significance of the slain Puerto Rican independence leader, Filiberto Ojeda Rios. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Puerto Rico by Eddie Palmieri here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the FBI killing of Puerto Rican independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios. Nearly a week has passed since FBI agents surrounded his house, resulting in a shootout that left Ojeda Rios dead and an FBI agent wounded. His killing has sparked an outpouring of anti-U.S. sentiment in Puerto Rico and fears that the Bush administration will launch a new crackdown on the independence movement there. Earlier this week, tens of thousands attended his funeral, making it one of the largest in Puerto Rican history. Puerto Ricans of all political stripes have questioned the FBI's actions, especially because the shooting took place on September 23rd, the anniversary of the 1868 uprising against Spanish rule.
The FBI considered Ojeda Rios a fugitive from justice and the head of a domestic terrorist group, the militant Puerto Rican independence group Los Macheteros. But in Puerto Rico, he's long been viewed as a leader of the independence movement. Now many see him as a martyr who was killed at the hands of U.S. agents. Puerto Rican officials and Amnesty International are calling for an independent probe into his death. Amnesty said the killing should be considered an extrajudicial execution if the FBI deliberately killed Ojeda Rios or deliberately left him to die when they could have arrested him. Although FBI agents shot him Friday afternoon at his home, they waited 20 hours before entering the house. Autopsy reports show he bled to death from a gunshot wound to his shoulder. We go now to Puerto Rico to speak with Jorge Farinacci. He is a spokesperson for the Puerto Rican Socialist Front and friend of Filiberto Ojeda Rios. He's on the phone from San Juan. Juan?
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jorge.
Yes, good morning, and good morning to all your audience.
Could you talk a little bit about the demonstration yesterday and the reactions in the last couple of days to the events of last week?
Well, it's incredible the way the Puerto Rican people have gone out to the streets since the night of the murder. That night, 3 or 4 hours after everybody knew what was happening, although not, it was not official that he had been murdered, but everybody knew that something strange and fishy was happening. Thousands of people poured to the streets, mainly called by the student movement in Puerto Rico. They brought the students put barricades in the streets. They started marching around the San Juan area, and since that day, the island has been on a turmoil.
Well, I know that the three Puerto Rican Congress members in the United States, Luis Gutierrez, Jose Serrano, and Nidia Velasquez, immediately issued a statement over the weekend demanding an investigation, and the FBI has now said that it is looking into what occurred. But what's been the reaction of the political leaders in Puerto Rico, and it would obviously be expected that the supporters of independence and who saw Ojeda Rios as a hero would rally in protest. But also there's been lots of concern expressed by populares and those who are in favor of statehood as well. Could you talk about
that? Yes, that is correct. And I think the reason for that is that the people of Puerto Rico, notwithstanding their political positions, understood clearly that this was a murder, that this was an arrogant, prepotence, and vengeful event planned by the FBI. And even though there are many differences within the Puerto Rican community regarding our future, there's a lot of national pride. And Puerto Ricans don't like it to be pushed, don't like to be harassed, don't like to be that our leaders would be murdered in cold blood without any kind of response. I think that the dignity of the Puerto Rican people was hurt very badly by this planned murder by the FBI.
Talk about the significance of the actual date that they chose to try to arrest him. He'd been a fugitive for more than 15 years, and he was also customarily he would issue interviews or statements on September 23rd, El Grito de Lares. Can you talk about the significance of that date, and obviously that the FBI knew that the significance of that date as well?
Well, Well, that is correct. The Grito de Lares is more or less like the 4th of July for North Americans. It's the day that we proclaim our independence from Spain, although that revolution was crushed. The resistance, the flame, the desire for independence has always present in Puerto Rico for the last 150 years. And there's a commemoration of that day every year in Puerto Rico in the town of Lares. This time, this year, thousands and thousands of Puerto Ricans, we gather in Lares to not only commemorate the Grito de Lares, but also to reaffirm our right to self-determination, our right to independence, and a call for the end of the colonial relation that the United States has imposed in Puerto Rico. Since the last years, Filiberto Ojeda has constantly been one of the present in Lares through video messages or audio messages that are that when they come to the audience, everybody started silent to hear his message. His message they hear was a message of unity, was a message of national reconciliation, and was a very positive message to the Puerto Rican people. And it's ironic that at the same time that message was being made to be addressed to the public there, the FBI had 200 agents surrounding his house and preparing to murder him.
We're talking to Jorge Farinacci, spokesperson for the Puerto Rican Socialist Front, friend of Filiberto Ojeda Rios, and also joining us on the line now also from Puerto Rico, Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua, who is an independent political analyst in Puerto Rico, hosts one of the island's most popular radio programs on Noti Uno. Juan.
Welcome, Juan Manuel, to the program.
Welcome, my friend, and thanks for having me, and my regards to Jorge.
Juan Manuel, your perspective, we've been talking about the events of the past few days, the massive protest that occurred yesterday, as well as the statements of many Puerto Rican leaders, both on the island and in the United States, demanding an investigation into the events. Your perspective on what's happened in the past few days?
Yes, I have no doubt whatsoever that a political assassination occurred in Puerto Rico by a special team with a special rifle against Filiberto Ojeda Rios, who was left to bleed to death and killed, in effect, murdered by a team from the United States. And the investigation will show that. And I don't have any doubt whatsoever that the government of Puerto Rico contributed to that event by turning off the lights in the barrio where Filiberto Ojeda Rios lived. The 200 houses were left without light in the evening so that the sharpshooter with his laser and special rifles could kill Filiberto. So that's the story, that's the truth, and I am sure it will have to come out in the investigation by the Inspector General of the United States.
Juan Manuel, you had met with Ojeda Rios a number of times, interviewing him both, as you described, at the courthouse, but also when he was underground.
Yes.
Right. How did you meet with him, known as a gardener of roses for many years to the people in his community?
Well, persons that knew us both put us in contact, and I obviously was not privy to observe how I got there or where I was, but I am convinced, again, that he had never abandoned his fight for independence, and that he was living with his wife in a house in the mountains, as I said, gardening roses and reading. We just got today a picture of the books. And we got also pictures of the more than 100 rounds that were shot at his home on the September 23rd intervention.
Do you think it's fair to say he died in a shootout?
No, he did not die in a shootout. He was attacked in his home with 100 shots. He responded with 10 shots, but then he was killed by a single bullet shot by a sharpshooter from high ground, or, well, high ground, let's put it that way. And the single bullet went through his clavicle and wounded him. He fell against the floor and tried to prevent bleeding, but he was left there bleeding for hours until he died.
Now, to what extent did the local police officials in Puerto Rico participate or know about this? You mentioned the lights being turned out, but some of the statements from the superintendent of police, Pedro Toledo, have suggested that they knew very little about what was going on.
The problem with that theory, Juan, is that there is no way that the lights could have been turned off in the barrio, in the 200 houses in the barrio, with an express authorization of the electrical governmental company. And that order must have come, I have said here, from La Fortaleza.
Jorge Farnacci, I wanted to ask you about the statement of Los Macheteros vowing to avenge Ojeda Rios's death in a statement that was read to mourners at the funeral, saying, "Yankees, murderers, your days are numbered. The fight will continue now and until the Yankees leave our soil." It was read, it was signed by Commander Guasabara from somewhere on the island. The significance of this statement.
Well, it's very obvious that some kind of feeling of revenge is in the Puerto Rican people, but I would urge our movement to restrain from that. We think that the proper response is the mobilization, strengthen our movement, and continue the struggles. Right now, we are in a position that we have gained a lot with our people. This murder has shown very clearly to all Puerto Ricans and many people all around Latin America and the United States the real character of the relation of Puerto Rico with the United States. And I think that we should take Filiberto's death and have an advantage in the next months and years in terms of a struggle. I just don't think revenge at this time would be the proper way to advance our struggle and honor our hero and our martyr.
Jorge Farnacci, I want to thank you for being with us, spokesperson for the Puerto Rican Socialist Front, friend of Filiberto Ojeda Rios, and Juan Manuel Garcia Basilacqua, political analyst, host of one of the island's most popular radio programs on Noti1. Thank you so much, both. That does it for today's broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. You can hear, you can watch the show, you can see the video images, you can get transcripts. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.